Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. My name is George Knapp. Happy to be sitting in on a beautiful Saturday evening, and pleased that you've decided to spend some time with us over the next 4 hours. We are marking the 50th anniversary of what should have been a not-so-remarkable event. A British rock band made its debut in America, went on the Ed Sullivan Show, then on a tour. And you wouldn't think that those events would be something people were still talking about a half century later. But the band was the Beatles. And as the saying goes, that band changed everything. Not just music, but pop culture, hair, clothes, politics, attitudes. The Beatles and the British invasion that followed heralded some massive changes of the 1960s, the battles that we're still fighting decades later, even now. More than 500 books have been written about the Beatles, and while I certainly haven't read them all, or even a minor percentage of all those books, there is one biography of the band that can be called definitive. It was a massive bestseller when it first came out. Now a spin-off has been released by Time Life, specifically about the British invasion portion of it. The guy who wrote both of them, Bob Spitz, spent close to 8 years researching and writing. He interviewed 650 people. He wrote one version of this book that was more than 2,700 pages long and had to be cut into a book about a third that size. That's the one we're going to talk about tonight. It is a magnificent piece of work, and it's brought back so many memories of music that's been sort of the soundtrack of our lives, those of us who have been around for a while, certainly for the past five decades. Even though this band was together for only a couple of years and recorded a total of less than 11 hours of music when you put all their albums together, all put together, it's less than 11 hours. Coming up tonight, a look back at how the Beatles changed us and changed the world, and the secrets and details that few people ever knew about the most popular musical act in history. Bob Spitz, as we'll learn, has led a pretty interesting life himself. For a time, he managed Bruce Springsteen and later Elton John. He's written other acclaimed books, and he will join me in the second half of tonight's program. But first, a NASA insider comes clean. Haven't you always suspected those NASA guys know more than they're saying about extraterrestrial life? It seems like every time they get close to a discovery or an announcement, it almost feels like they don't want it to be true. They don't want the public to speculate about life on Mars, for example. Don't pay attention to that face. It's just a trick of light and shadow. Don't pay attention to the meteorites with the ancient fossils. They've poured cold water on every scientist who's ever announced that ET life may have in fact been confirmed in rocks or meteorite fragments from Mars or elsewhere. It's just kind of weird. Richard Hoover isn't just any NASA staffer. He's an astrobiologist who's written 250 scientific papers. He holds 11 patents. He was the head of NASA's astrobiology program until his retirement in 2011. And in 1992, he was named NASA's Inventor of the Year. Three different times, Richard Hoover has announced the discovery and confirmation of what he believes to be extraterrestrial life. And each time, NASA has done its best to just kind of stomp on that news. Tonight, we hear the story from his own mouth. Coming up in just a few minutes, Richard Hoover talks about the most important question that we will ever ask or answer. Is there life elsewhere? Webmaster Sean and I put together an assortment of news items and oddities of recent vintage, stories that I think will be of interest to our Coast listeners. It's listed under the Knapp's News on the Coast to Coast website if you want to check it out, including two stories about unique ways that scientists are now searching for exoplanets, those that exist outside our immediate solar system. Also there, an appropriate story in more ways than one, it's about an auction of John Lennon's artwork, specifically his drawings, doodles really, related to his UFO sighting in New York City. And I can just think, man, I can never afford that thing, but that would be pretty cool to hang up in your living room, no? One other quick news note, in case you have not heard this so far, debris has been recovered by both a Chinese warship and an Australian ship that might be from the missing Malaysian airliner. Planes and ships are still scouring that part of the Indian Ocean, but have been hampered somewhat today by bad weather. There is no official confirmation yet that the debris picked up is from Flight 370, but they could have that answer soon. This Chinese ship dropped buoys to mark the spot where the debris was found. Sounds like we're getting close to solving at least part of this mystery. But of course, like you, I have the feeling we may never know what led to this tragedy. And 20 years from now, we're still going to be speculating or arguing about what went down on that ill-fated plane, other than the plane itself. Time now for our first break. When we come back, the search for ET life with longtime NASA scientist Richard Hoover. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program. As I mentioned moments ago, Richard Hoover wasn't exactly a run-of-the-mill NASA scientist. At NASA's Marshall Flight Center, he founded the Astrobiology Research Group. That's the team tasked with finding evidence, analyzing evidence of extraterrestrial life, analyzing rock samples, meteorite samples, that sort of thing. And Hoover says there is solid, valid evidence for life outside of Earth, but the story has been buried or dismissed by his former employer. He's currently working as an astrobiologist at Athens State University and also as a visiting research professor with the Center for Astrobiology at the University of Buckingham in the United Kingdom. And welcome to the program for the first time, Richard Hoover.
Yes, hello. I'm delighted to be with you tonight.
Me too. I'm glad to have you on. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Tell us, Richard, how long have you been part of this search for ET life, or rather biomarkers of such life?
Well, actually, right after David McKay announced the discovery of possible microfossils in the Mars meteorite, ALH-84001, I initiated the program at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center to study evidence for microfossils in ancient terrestrial rocks and also to search for evidence of microfossils in meteorites.
I can imagine it's an exciting time. That was, what, 97?
96 was when the announcement was made, and quite frankly, I have to tell you, when the announcement was made, I was a bit dismayed because I was of the opinion that everyone knew that extraterrestrial life existed in the form of microfossils in meteorites. So I thought it was a bit strange that NASA was making such a big hoopla about microfossils in a Mars meteorite.
Well, why did you think that? What evidence had you seen by that point?
Well, there was a large body of evidence that was produced way back in 1962. This was done by Bartholomew Nagy and George Klaus when they found evidence of microfossils in carbonaceous meteorites, specifically the Orgeia meteorite, the same meteorite that I've been studying extensively. And they made this announcement of evidence for microfossils in a meteorite in 1962, and this caused a tremendous stir. They had found little tiny spherical bodies, some of which had spikes, and they were convinced that these were biological in nature rather than abiotic crystals and so forth. And so there was a large body of scientific research, including the Nobel laureate Harold Urey. And there was a big meeting at the New York Academy of Sciences, and all of this was discussed in detail with a lot of scientists who knew a great deal about paleontology, about microfossils, and so forth. But ultimately, they had detractors, and scientists from the University of Chicago argued that these were either pollen grains that had been squashed flat, or they were contaminants, modern contaminants. And in spite of that fact, there were other scientists who found much more complex structures, in fact, forms very similar to what I've been finding in the carbonaceous meteorites myself.
Am I reading it wrong that that it was a really exciting time, though, when NASA makes the announcement? I mean, you know, you said that a year later or in the following year, they established the Astrobiology Research Group. I would think that would be a pretty exciting assignment, pretty exciting work.
Oh, the announcement of David McKay was very exciting because, again, NASA took up the serious consideration of the possibility of extraterrestrial life. And what was done was there was the establishment of a number of virtual astrobiology institutes. I was fortunate enough to team up with David McKay and became co-investigator with Dave on the Center for Biomarkers in Astromaterials. And also, I teamed up with Ken Nielsen at NASA JPL. Ken was involved in the study of what are called microbial extremophiles. These are microorganisms on Earth that live in the most extreme and inhospitable environments. The reason the study of extremophiles is important is we wanted to find out what are the conditions in which life can exist on Earth in order to know where and how to search for life on Mars, on Europa, and elsewhere in the cosmos.
And basically, everywhere you look, you found life. I know some of that work has been done right here in the Mojave in a very, very extreme environment. And I know you've found evidence, NASA has found evidence here of life in improbable places as well as in Antarctica, right?
As a matter of fact, virtually anywhere that you look on the planet Earth where the conditions for life exist, you will find life. And those conditions are relatively simple. You have to have water, but that water doesn't have to be an ocean. It can be a tiny, thin film of water existing between grains of rocks, of sandstone, in the dry valleys of Antarctica. It can be inside of glaciers, inside of the polar ice caps. It can be deep within the crust of the Earth, as Tullis Onstott has shown in the studies of microbial life deep within the gold mines of South Africa.
I think I read that in 1997, the same year you set up this research group, you made an announcement, basically the same kind of announcement that McKay had made, right, about finding evidence of life.
Yes, that's correct. When David McKay's announcement came out, quite frankly, as I said before, I was a bit shocked at all of the excitement, and it did cause a tremendous amount of excitement. As you recall, President Clinton held a panel with Dave McKay and a number of others, so it triggered the formation of the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which was originally headed up by Jerry Sofen, who had been heavily involved in the Viking program, which was the only NASA program that we had that really did search for extraterrestrial life on the planet Mars. After Viking concluded its studies, NASA did not engage in any subsequent searches for extant life on the planet Mars, which was in itself a shocking kind of result. But after David McKay made his announcement, NASA established these virtual astrobiology institutes, and it resulted in a tremendous amount of excitement. Scientists from all over the world came together and started studying a wide variety of things related to what now was called astrobiology. Previously, the search for evidence for extraterrestrial life had been termed exobiology, but most of the NASA studies in exobiology had not been really in searching for extraterrestrial life. It had been concerned primarily with continuations of the Miller-Urey experiment in order to try to understand, okay, how did life originate on the planet Earth? That was the fundamental assumption, that ancient lightning bolts and large events on the planet Earth caused the origin of life on Earth about 3.8 or 3.9 billion years ago. The problem is that life may not have originated on Earth. Life may have been brought to Earth from elsewhere in the solar system and landed on Earth and started growing when the planet became hospitable for life.
Panspermia, right?
Panspermia, it is. It's a theory that has gone back a couple of centuries and has largely been dismissed by the scientific community because the paradigm was that life originated on early Earth, and if you have the planet being infected by life from elsewhere in the cosmos, then you've got a significant problem with your fundamental hypothesis.
So, McKay makes an announcement in 96. It causes a big hubbub. What about your announcement? How was it received the first time
well,
you said it?
Well, actually, it was sort of not received. It was pretty much ignored. What happened was after Dave McKay made his announcement, I thought, well, everyone knows that there are microfossils in carbonaceous meteorites. At least I knew that. I had known it for years. In fact, I had discussed it in detail with Sir Robert Ross, who had done some of the pioneering studies back in the 1960s. Bob Ross was a brilliant diatomist, and he had come to work with me in Antwerp at the Henri van Herk Museum. And we had a chance to talk about his research on microfossils in meteorites back in the early 1960s. So I knew that there were microfossils in carbonaceous meteorites and that it had been well established. I didn't know that the scientific community had essentially dismissed this set of results and said, okay, this is all wrong. It was all simply a big mistake, and it was based on either mistaking terrestrial pollen grains for extraterrestrial life, or it was based on mistaking abiotic grains as biological. So based on that knowledge, I said, well, the proper thing for me to do is study carbonaceous meteorites. And at that point in time, we had some wonderful instruments at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center. We had some magnificent scanning electron microscopes. And so I obtained a piece of a meteorite called the Murchison meteorite that fell in Australia in 1969. And I was acutely aware of the criticisms that were coming to bear on David McKay, namely that these tiny things that he found in the Mars meteorite were either crystals or abiotic structures that had nothing to do with biology, or if they were biology, they were contaminants that crawled into the meteorite after it landed in Antarctica, or that they were simply structures that appeared to be so, but they were so small you couldn't really tell what they were. So what I decided to do, and one of the arguments was that they were coating artifacts, that they had been produced when he used the kind of coatings that were used to make the microscope capable of seeing these structures with high resolution. Typically, you use gold plating in order to make the surface conductive and get higher resolution. So I decided I didn't want to have to argue about coating artifacts. And in order to avoid coating artifacts, the best thing to do is just don't coat the sample. And we had a microscope called an environmental scanning electron microscope that could look at samples that were uncoated and non-conductive. So I got this piece of the Murchison meteorite and set forth to develop a rigid protocol for how to handle the meteorite so that I wouldn't introduce any contamination. I decided the best way to prevent modern biological contamination is by flame sterilization. Bacteria don't do very good when they're subjected to a propane torch. It converts them immediately into smoke. So what I did is I took all of my tools and instruments and I used a propane torch and heated them to glowing red hot. And then very carefully in a sterile environment, fractured the sample of the Murchison meteorite that I had, took the freshly broken surface and put it where that it was facing up on an electron microscope stub, put it in the microscope, and started searching for microfossils with my colleague Greg German at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center materials branch. And within about 10 minutes, we found a tiny little mushroom-shaped structure that excited me because a lot of the workers in the 1960s had reported finding mushroom-shaped biological entities. But it was very small, not much bigger than what David McKay had been finding. And so we were carefully focusing it at 50,000 times magnification and getting everything just perfect. And we were using a 30 kilovolt electron beam and almost ready to take our picture, and all of a sudden, it vanished. It vanished. We had struck it with such a high-intensity electron beam that this little guy was made almost entirely out of carbon, and we vaporized the puppy.
Oh,
so it was kind of ironic, almost like Mars Attacks. I mean, the first time you find an extraterrestrial life form, you hit it with a high intensity electron beam and you send it off into a vapor of smoke.
Oh my gosh.
All we had left was a tiny little indentation in the shape of a mushroom where it had been in the rock.
Well, as we were going to find out, though, this is not the only time that evidence that you were working with was destroyed. And when we come back, we're going to hear the story about what some of your superiors at NASA did to get rid of some evidence that was pretty compelling. We're talking with Richard Hoover, former NASA scientist. And I got to imagine a bunch of NASA guys sitting around a table wondering, what are we going to do about Richard Hoover? You can't just write this guy off as being some kind of a kook or label him as being like a UFO nut, as NASA often talks about the search for extraterrestrial life. So what do they do about Richard Hoover? Because the story he's about to tell us is pretty compelling. And it's about how NASA, his bosses, purposely destroyed solid evidence of extraterrestrial life. We'll get to that when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Hoover, before the break, you were telling us that you and your colleagues were examining an Australian meteorite fragment, and you took you only a couple of minutes to find a curious shape of an object, a mushroom-shaped structure that you think might have been evidence of ET life, but you accidentally zapped it. So you're left with this mushroom-shaped hole there. I guess that's not evidence of much of anything, is it?
Hey, it was quite disappointing, to be honest. But we pressed on, and within a matter of a few hours, we found filaments that were consistent with life forms called cyanobacteria, and we took a lot of photographs of these filaments and started doing an extensive study of the microorganisms that are known as cyanobacteria, and putting different kinds of cyanobacteria that I obtained in living in pure culture from the Carolina Biological Supply, but also that I collected in situ from lakes like Lake Gunnersville near my home. And by taking living cyanobacteria, we put them on the same environmental scanning electron microscope to understand what did cyanobacteria really look like when we examined them under the electron microscope. We rapidly recognized that we were finding filamentous cyanobacterial remains in these meteorites. This was tremendously exciting to me. I wrote a scientific paper about the subject. This was published in 1997. I organized a conference at SPIE that we had in San Diego. We had a number of the pioneers there, people like Dave McKay came, Tommy Gold, Robert Shapiro, Tullis Onstott, a lot of scientists working in many different fields. And I presented these results at that first meeting in 1997 and showed evidence for microfossils in the Murchison carbonaceous meteorite at that time. We also had scientists that came from Russia. One of the hallmarks of good science is, are your observations and results repeatable, and are you the only one that sees them? If you're the only one that finds these things, then it's got to be suspicious. But after I sent my initial draft of my paper to David McKay to have him review it and give me his comments and criticisms, David called me back and he said, "You realize that scientists in Russia are finding very similar things." And I said, "No, I didn't realize that." And he said, "Well, I received a paper from at that time he wasn't academician, Rozanov, from Professor Rozanov, the director of the Paleontological Institute of the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow, in which he had found similar microfossils in the Murchison meteorite." So I gave Dave permission to send my paper to Professor Rozanov. And Professor Rozanov and I then got together and started collaborating. I would go to the Russian Academy of Sciences, to the Institute of Paleontology, and work with him there. And he would come to the Marshall Space Flight Center and work with me here. But we had actually found very similar things, written very similar results, and the publications came out almost simultaneously, his being published in Russia and mine being published here in the United States.
Okay, you get something published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, that says a lot. It says that at least you convinced that journal that you had enough evidence to put it out there, right?
Well, it says that we did our work very carefully, and we were providing evidence. And by that, I mean the photomicrographs that were presented as well as the spectral data. When I did these studies, I not only took pictures of the structures that I was finding, I also took photographs of similar life forms that we have here on Earth. So I was comparing them to what are absolutely known to be living organisms on Earth and showing that they had not only the same precise structural characteristics, but they were also the proper size range, which is very important. Living things live within very distinct sizes. You don't find a dog that's the size of an elephant, and you don't find a dog that's the size of a bacterium. Living things live within very distinct size ranges, and these fossils that I was finding in the meteorite were in the proper size range for the living cyanobacteria that I was finding here on Earth that belonged to the same genera and species of the ones that I was finding representatives of in the meteorites. So that provided evidence that they were in fact biological. The big problem, of course, is now how do you prove that they are not contaminants that crawled into the meteorite after it landed, in the case of the one in Australia in 1969, or in the case of the Orgeille meteorite, which landed in France in May of 1864. And in order to do that, I started doing research using X-ray spectroscopy to measure the chemical composition of the fossils found in the rocks and the chemical composition of living and dead organisms that were similar on Earth.
Tell me this. I know that there was reaction to the paper that you presented and the findings, but that's how science works. You publish something and other guys try to test the hypothesis or look at the data, give their opinion. Was the reaction from your colleagues different from what you would expect? I mean, was there a sort of a negative tone to the findings that was beyond what you might have expected for anything else?
Well, actually, no. At the very beginning, in 1997, there was no negative reaction from scientists within NASA or scientists anywhere else, to my knowledge. I mean, these papers were published. They were discussed extensively at these meetings, generally, they were extremely well received, and no one provided criticism, saying that they thought my results and my findings were incorrect. Of course, in the 1990s, the scientific community was still quite enthralled with David McKay's results, and so NASA was embarking on an astrobiology program, and they were actually looking at how do we develop vehicles to go to Mars and get sample returns to bring back to Earth. How do we develop space vehicles that can go to Europa and take samples from Europa to search for life in the watery ocean underneath the ice crust of Europa? So in the late 90s, there was a great deal of enthusiasm for astrobiology within NASA. There was a great deal of enthusiasm for astrobiology within the entire country. As you remember from those days, it was tremendously exciting because everyone was thinking, okay, we're going to now crack this question, are we alone? And we're going to find the fundamental answer to a question that has been intriguing to man since the beginning of time.
You said a couple of minutes ago when you're talking about the Viking program that it seemed to be shocking to you that Viking was the last time NASA sent something to Mars to look for life. They've sent all these other craft up there, rovers all over the place, but without the equipment to do the test on the spot to find out if life is there. It just seems really weird.
They keep sending rovers. that do excellent searches for rocks on Mars, and they've been doing getting astonishing results by finding lots of rocks on Mars. Although I think most people would recognize that, yep, there are rocks on Mars. The problem is none of the subsequent experiments after Viking, after Gil Levin obtained evidence for life on Mars during Viking, none of those scientific missions carried out by NASA has carried any kind of instrumentation to search for living organisms on the planet Mars. All of them have been, well, gee, we've got to follow the water. We've got to see if there really was ever water on Mars. And to me, that was also a shocking kind of thing, because it has been known since Viking that the polar ice caps of Mars contain glacial ice, which is frozen H2O. And as a scientist, as far as I'm concerned, H2O is water. It doesn't matter whether it's frozen in your refrigerator in an ice cube, or whether it comes out of your tea kettle as steam, or whether it's in a glass sitting in front of you, it's still water. And anyone who likes to crunch ice like I do at the end of a Coca-Cola knows that water that's frozen is still water. And once you've crunched it up and melted it in your mouth, it tastes just as good as it does when it comes out of an Avian bottle.
Well, a lot of us don't get it. It would seem to be counterintuitive for NASA to not want to look for evidence of life. I mean, if they found it, it would seem to be there'd be a call for greater investment in NASA. Let's get up there and get some solid proof. But it seems like every time you turn around, they don't want to find it. Tell me the story about the destruction of evidence that you were working with.
Well, actually, George, the answer is I don't get it either. I find it really, really astonishing. Now, the destruction of evidence is not actually something that I was working with. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know about it at the time. What happened was in February of 2004, the NASA Opportunity rover was doing all of this wonderful work on the surface of Mars, and it took a photograph of a very interesting structure on a rock on Mars, and it took that photograph on 17th of February 2004 at 11:30:35 Mars local solar time. And the problem was, in this picture, you see three of the famous blueberries, but also you see a very, very unusual structure, which has some pentagonal plates and comes up with segmented arms that are what are called bifurcated or branching. And that picture, when a paleontologist who knows about organisms called crinoids looks at it, as I do. I've got a large collection of crinoids. I've been collecting crinoids for many, many years. The instant that I saw the picture, I said, my God, they've got a photograph of a crinoid on Mars. Now, a crinoid is not like a cyanobacteria. A crinoid is a multicellular organism. They are similar to starfish. They're echinoderms. In fact, crinoids live on Earth today. And they have been on Earth for hundreds of millions of years, and paleontologists have studied them for literally centuries. And so they're a very well-known group of life forms on Earth and a very well-known group of fossils. Well, the shocking thing about all of this is not that this picture was taken and not that this wonderful structure was found, but that 3.5 hours after the photograph was taken, the rock abrasion tool was used to grind that structure to dust. And when I say that, you might think, well, this is an astonishing claim that cannot be supported. But if you actually go to the NASA website and you do a search for the proper frame numbers, you can find that one frame taken at 11:30:35 on Sol 24, February 17, 2004, shows the form that has the characteristics of a crinoid, and the next image taken on February 17, 2004, Sol 24, at 14:34:10, Mars local solar time, shows the three blueberries that surround it have been sectioned where they've been ground, the rounded surface are gone, and you're looking right at the center of the blueberries, and where the crinoid had been lying is nothing but a flat, smooth surface with that structure completely removed.
Well, that's just, that seems unbelievable. That you, I mean, if you had a fossil on Earth and you were, it was curious and it looked really interesting, I don't think you'd do an experiment that destroyed it, would you?
No paleontologist that I know of or have ever met would consider doing such a thing. Every time that you find an interesting fossil, and I've spent a great deal of time collecting fossils, you get very excited. If it's in a rock, you may want to spend many hours carefully chipping around the edges so that you can chip it out and bring it home and bring it back to the laboratory for detailed study. But no one would ever think, oh, give me a rock hammer. I want to bash that to bits to see what it looks like on the inside. No paleontologist would ever do this. And the fact that that structure was ground to dust is, to me, the most shocking thing I have encountered in my entire 46-year career at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
So give me the lowdown on NASA. I mean, do they want to find it or not? You must have had conversations around the water cooler with colleagues there. Hey, what the heck is going on? Why would something like that happen? Do we really want to find evidence of ET life or not?
Well, as a matter of fact, I think the evidence is solid that there have been actually meetings where people were preparing to write their proposals to study Mars. And when NASA officials have said, if you're planning to submit a proposal to search for evidence of extant life on Mars, don't bother, your proposal will not be evaluated. That has happened. And so that clearly says that there, for some reason, is a significant and serious determination that at this point in time, officials within the agency were not really interested in searching for evidence of life on Mars. And what happened to this particular rock, I think, is evidence that they not only do not want to search for it, they seem to be frightened about the possibility of finding it.
Wow. I don't get that. I don't understand it. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't get it either. I can't explain it to you. I wish I could. I wish I understood what was going on. But quite frankly, to me, it is totally bizarre and impossible to explain.
I want to ask this question a different way. The reaction you said to your paper among the general scientific community was not hostile. Is there hostility in the general scientific community to the search for extraterrestrial life? I mean, everyone says it's out there. It would be really a monumental discovery with the day we find conclusive evidence. But it seems like when the topic comes up, especially the more exotic aspects of it that we can talk about it a little bit, that there is pronounced hostility and a lack of interest in among scientists in looking at evidence about it.
George, I'm sorry. I didn't make myself clear. When I said the reaction to my paper was not hostile, I was talking about the scientific papers that I published in 1997.
Okay.
And in 98 and 99 and 2000 and 2004 and 2007. None of those papers received any degree of hostility within NASA, within the agency. In fact, NASA sponsored the NATO Advanced Study Institute that I chaired with Academician Rozanov in Hanya, Crete, where papers that I did and others were published, peer-reviewed and published. And the book that was published is called Perspectives in Astrobiology, and it was funded by NATO and by NASA and supported by NASA. There was no hostility within the agency to this research during this early period. The hostility did occur in 2011, as you probably recall. I published a review paper in a journal called the Journal of Cosmology. To me, this was not an important paper. It was a sort of an overall review of the research that I'd been doing for almost a decade and a half at that point in time, with the In fact, most of the pictures of microfossils that I published, I had previously published elsewhere. And the reason I did that is I didn't want to prevent new evidence from being unavailable for publication in other scientific journals by putting it in a review paper.
Richard Hoover, I'm asking you to hold on for a moment. We're going to pick up that conversation on the other side.